Welcome back to our second presentation for the fourth False Flag and Conspiracies Conference this Saturday, which will extend through Sunday to 10 p.m. in the evening. I'm very, very pleased to introduce our second speaker, who is a licensed private investigator in Texas, where we first encountered one another when he gave a presentation on a show of mine about the use of techniques available on the internet for conducting research. Since that included photographs, I just sent him a photograph without identifying its location or its context. And he came back and identified it as a crime scene investigative vehicle in the parking lot at Sandy Hook on the evening of the 14th, after the event had officially occurred, which was striking. The photograph is so important because in the background, you can see the windows at classroom 10 are unbroken. And yet, the Connecticut State Police would report them as having been shot out, oddly enough, from the outside in. So I knew this guy was something very, very special. He has a knack for cracking these false flag events. He's done completely brilliant work on Uvalde, on Buffalo, on Nashville, and I'm very proud that we co-authored a false flag and stage event checklist for law enforcement, which you can find. I've now made it available to download for the program. If you go to my blog at jameshfetzer.org, just scroll down the front page. It's about the sixth blog in now, since other events, of course, have been taking place. But you can click there and download yourself this three-page document with lots of links and instructions, you know, advice about how to sort out real events from fake ones. It's my great pleasure to introduce Brian Davidson.
Hi, everybody. Of course, many people log into our weekly broadcast that I do generally with either Carl Herman or Scott Bennett, Don Gron, and others. I'm glad to be joining the conference this year. One of the challenges I had was that I was asked to put together a couple of presentations for a couple of hours, and then we had a scheduling adjustment, so I had to make some plans to basically condense both those presentations into one. And then as I got to thinking about it and reflecting on it, I just decided to make it all delivered in a story format. So I'm not going to do a traditional PowerPoint with you. More, I'm going to talk about experience and how to evaluate these events to determine their authenticity in terms of whether the actors are genuine or not. So just to give you a little bit of opening, I would like to tell my story, and which really begins about April of 2016. I was up visiting my sister in Seattle, and she said, hey, look into this Sandy Hook thing. Something's not quite right with it. And I went back to my office and I sat down. And remember, I'm a licensed private investigator. I've got pretty good open source intelligence skills, which basically means advanced computer searching. And so I went back to my office after that meeting with her in April, and I started taking a look at some of the Sandy Hook material, where I ran across Jim's book on Sandy Hook. And so I wasn't convinced. You got to remember, at this point in time, I'm just a normal guy. I listen to Fox News, and I've got, you know, Bill O'Reilly and Megyn Kelly and Tucker Carlson talking at night, whispering into my ear, and I'm reading the Drudge Report, and I'm thinking that I'm pretty well educated because I have some extra time to stay up on current events. Little did I know what was about to happen to me, because in June of 2016, an event took place called the Orlando Pulse nightclub shooting. And this is an important part of the story, because I want to really cover sort of mentally and emotionally what happens. Not everybody gets to experience it the same. But that Orlando Pulse nightclub shooting happened on, I believe it was a Friday night, June 16th in 2016, or maybe June 17th, 2016. And I remember seeing it on the news, thinking to myself, you know, something doesn't quite look right about this. And as I was watching more and more of Fox News cover the event, I saw this guy by the name of Norman Cassiano, as he was advertised on television, come onto the TV, and he was performing a an interview from the passenger seat of what appeared to be a gold Honda Civic, and this is on Fox News. And during the interview, he claims to have been a victim in the Orlando Pulse nightclub shooting, and he claims that he was shot by Omar Mateen at close range using a high-powered rifle. And he lifts up his shirt literally and shows a piece of gauze taped to his back, and claims that he was shot in the abdomen. Well, I'm a pretty avid hunter. I'd been out, I'd shot a lot of hogs. I knew what a high capacity magazine or high capacity rifle would do, or high capacity round would do to the human body, much less a pig's body. And so I said, something's not right about this. This guy Norman Cassiano's claiming he was shot six times. So I went into my office the next morning and I opened up my book, which right now I'm on the 10th edition. This is called Open Source Intelligence Techniques, by Michael Bazell. I think when I first was doing this in 2016, I was on maybe the fifth edition. So when it comes to advanced computer internet research, things move rather quickly. Anyway, I go back to my office and I said, I'm going to create a file on this Orlando thing, and I want to get to the bottom of this because I didn't understand what was happening. How could this guy be telling such a blatant lie on the television? And remember that I hadn't gone through the cognitive dissonance process at this point in time. I didn't know that how much of the world was fake and how much was real. So I started analyzing Orlando. And one of the videos that I came across was something that was done by a guy by the name of PK Truth, who was showing the trucks in the middle of the night picking up these victims out of the club and driving them supposedly to the hospital. Well, I knew as a licensed private investigator that I needed to start downloading all of this earliest and most reliable evidence. And so I used a number of different techniques that I'd gotten from the book and from practice. And I created a folder and I started downloading all of the images that I could find. I started downloading all of the early videos and early recordings that I could find. I used Twitter and other resources to identify all the earliest tweets that I could find and everything that originated from within a quarter mile of the scene. And at the time, I was using like a geo program where I was saying, give me every tweet or Facebook post that originated within this half mile radius around this particular geographical coordinate with that was the Pulse nightclub. And so I began to sort of create a file that monitored everything that happened in the first 4 hours of the event. Of course, as you're watching the event unfold, you're seeing all of the news cycles begin to change the story and adjust this and add more and add this. Well, I don't give any of that weight. I wanted to focus back on that original, earliest, and most reliable evidence because it was the closest thing to the actual source of the event that I could find. So I would go find the Facebook accounts that had the early Facebook posts. I would figure out who they really belonged to. How long was that account established? Where did it originate from? Who is it connected to? What organizations are they connected to? I did the same thing with early tweets. What media companies were at the site? What police officers were at the site? And what was amazing about that particular file was that this file that I had created on my own was strong enough to break what I considered to be my mind at the time, which was a rather sophisticated mind, but also a rather stubborn mind. Remember, generally people think of themselves as pretty smart, especially in this community. And I at the time thought, well, of course, I'm running this semi-successful private investigation company, if not really successful. I must be pretty smart. I must have my head on. Well, I had no idea what these events were. And so, literally, I had to sit in my office for the next maybe 2 weeks. And I would spend hours on it, maybe anywhere from 2 to 5 hours a day, going back through all my earliest and most reliable evidence related to Orlando that I had collected. And I had to make certain mental conclusions as to what really took place that day versus what the media told us. And of course, when the human mind hits a wall like this, and it's called, the word that we use is called cognitive dissonance. But what was actually happening to my mind was that I had a battle. Do I listen to the mainstream media? Do I listen to the television? Or do I let my own critical thinking play and my own instincts play? And so you've got these two opposing forces because they can't be synchronized. We'd like to think it's nice and easy and, oh, well, there's a little bit of deception here. No, there was a lot of deception here. But some people try to synchronize these events. Well, these were two totally opposing ideas. Number one, the idea was, hey, this whole thing is fake. This whole thing is staged. All these guys are actors. And number two, oh, wait, how could that possibly be? How could this many people be involved with it? How could Fox News be involved with it? How could all these people that I trusted up to this time be involved with it? Why is Drudge treating it like it's a real event? How come Glenn Beck or nobody else is breaking this thing out in terms of analyzing it? And really, this is where I began to start creating my list of what I considered to be trusted people, because I had to break through that event. I came out on the other side saying, who can I trust? Who can I trust? And I had to start adding new voices as much as I possibly could. I added in Dr. Fetzer. I added in Wolfgang. I added in PK Truth. I added in Ole Damegaard. I added in, like, and then a lot of fake guys too. A lot of guys that were selling smoke were added in. And I had to mentally do the work of dividing up who is it that can be trusted based on my absolute fundamental conclusion that these events were faked and perpetrated by actors. I had made that conclusion. And I got to tell you, that was a very exciting time for me, because that gave me a foundation to grab onto. Anytime I found myself drifting off course, listening to Bill O'Reilly at night or listening to some other commentator or listening, I had to always go back to, no, in my mind, I know that this is a faked event. And therefore, if somebody's out there, either they're deceived themselves, or they're just part of a mockingbird media, or they're truly searching for the truth and haven't quite found it yet. And then you start to categorize and build. Well, of course, once you begin digging into this rabbit hole, if they're willing to lie to me on this level, what other levels are they willing to lie to me at? And so you find yourself opening up all sorts of new ideas and concepts. I remember studying Planet Nine, and I remember studying, this and that. And of course, I have an old theology degree, and which was really interesting to me because, of course, I spent 6 years at Moody Institute in Chicago learning about the Bible. And so I had to get myself literally to the point where, hey, are you really willing to do this? Are you going to reevaluate the Bible based on the concept that, hey, you know that you can be deceived now because you were deceived prior to the Orlando events? And so I had to literally, I mean, it was a cognitive dissonance is a big word, but what literally happens inside the human being is that there's a sick, almost kooky feeling that begins to develop when you begin to realize that everything that you thought was a foundation in terms of everything you thought you know is breaking apart. And literally, the deeper I went into it, the farther I went back, the more I found that I was being conditioned about certain ideas and certain concepts from early childhood that needed to be rethought. And so I dug deeper. And of course, it took years to sort of break through on the other side and find myself where I'm finally feeling really solid about, hey, I think I've got a good feel for this world. Oh, hey, I think I've got it understood. I know I still need to rethink this and rethink that, but I think I'm beginning to feel it. And that's where I really started getting my sea legs. And it was through that process that I ended up getting the guts to stop by Jim's house up in Wisconsin. That was during COVID. I stopped by his house and he was recording a show, introduced myself, and his wife said, "You can't come in because you don't have a mask on," something like that. I said, "Okay, whatever." And I drove back, and then I contacted him again through Joe Olson, who's also here in Houston, a few weeks later. And Jim said, "You know, hey, this is a really interesting conversation that we're beginning to have. Would you mind, going on air about this?" And of course, I didn't have a lot of confidence, because I thought, well, I've never spoken publicly about any of this stuff. Matter of fact, I was scared to speak publicly about it because I thought, well, what's my family going to think? What's everybody? Because I had tried to convince other people that the media was lying to them about everything. And sometimes it went off well. And other times I lost all credibility. And other times they looked at me like I was from outer space. I mean, they just couldn't. But I began to find people that I really connected to. And Joe Olson down here in Houston and Dr. Fetzer started me out. And they said, "Hey, let's go ahead and do a show." And I said, "Okay." And we did our first show on, we didn't really have a topic. We did it on how to gather the earliest and most reliable evidence for a false flag so you can make up your own mind. And of course, to prepare for that show, I had built something on a platform called start.me. And if you're out there taking notes and you've got a notepad, I want you to write this down. Start.me is an application that I added to my Firefox. And what you can do is you can go into sort of their library and find a whole bunch of different links, bookmarks that are sort of very well organized and very updated from different people who do what's called open source intelligence research. Now, open source intelligence as a concept is a reverse image search, a reverse video search. What is the origin of this image? What is the origin of this video? What time was it posted? How do I sort my Google search engine results by date so I can find earliest and oldest? How do I use the Internet Archives, the Wayback Machine, to find old news broadcasts that I may have missed or that originated or occurred on other channels? How do I use alternative search engines other than Google? Now, I want to help you understand why this as a skill set in this particular industry is very important. Number one, if you were to go to Wikipedia today and look up any of the, let's see, I've indexed, and I've got big Excel spreadsheets on my computer, but I have personally indexed, I'm looking at my list right now, over 114 events that I consider to be highly suspicious related to, I think it was a false flag. I have them indexed by month, by year, by day. Well, here's something I can tell you. What I learned very early with Orlando is that the Wikipedia is absolutely controlled by some organization to update it. And somebody is out there trying to make all these results and all these things on these pages make sense. And if you get a very early Wikipedia, you'll get all sorts of, or very early page, you'll get all sorts of things that are actually true and all sorts of things that are even fake under that. But what happens is that all that information gets scrubbed over a period of months until they come up with what they consider to be an acceptable narrative as to what happens. And then they deliver that narrative as if it's the new truth. Now, what is this called? This is called historical revisionism. And so now, if I go tell somebody, hey, Orlando Pulse nightclub event was fake, the very first thing they're going to do is they're going to go look up a Wikipedia and say, what happened? Well, where's the basics? What's the fundamentals? Or they're going to try to just type it into Google. Well, I can tell you for a fact that Wikipedia is adjusting to support the mainstream media narrative. I can tell you for a fact that the Google search index results are adjusted to weight very, very heavily toward very, very heavily towards the mainstream media narrative. And what they're doing is they're careful, and this was happening even back in 2016, is they're carefully filtering out the voices of dissent. People like me, people like Dr. Fetzer, people like others. And so as we become smaller, the mainstream media narrative continues
Watching
to
Peter
grow.
O'Connor.
Now, why? Why? And I've got to, I'm going to talk with you a little bit about budgets real fast, okay? I spent a lot of time preparing my second presentation because my second presentation was something that I had stumbled upon during the course of evaluating false flags through the lens of a private investigator, okay? Early on, when you're there, things that you can't explain might be sort of collected in your mind as sort of a spiritual type of event, or there's some sort of demon under a rock or behind a corner. But as you get more advanced into understanding exactly
Where
what these events are, you begin to realize that they're driving
are you? I'm looking at
expenses, they're
the top
driving
of the
money.
screen. It says Red Legion
Hey,
Warriors.
whoever's in the call.
Brian, you're muted. You're muted. Unmute. Unmute. Gary, unmute Brian.
Okay, I've got it. Okay, I'm
There we
back
go.
on. All right. So let's talk about money because I think I've already given a little bit of enough to understand without taking you through the full course on open source intelligence, which again, this is my basic volume, Michael Bazell's Open Source Intelligence. That combined, but basically fundamentally what's under here is a lot of understanding in terms of code and a lot of bookmarks in terms of places that I go to find things. And as a private investigator, I'm going to get specialized information, which I can't necessarily share with the public, but let's just say that I have special knowledge about the identities of people when I see a false flag event develop. I can use facial recognition, a reverse facial recognition search. I can find their real identities. I may be able to figure out their birthdays or their addresses or their phone numbers because maybe I want to conduct an investigation. And remember, I'm a licensed private investigator. Whether I'm paid or not, I can conduct an investigation on anything I want to conduct an investigation on. There's nothing that limits me. Now, how I use my resources to conduct that investigation does have some limitations. I can't violate people's privacy in terms of breaking out like their social security number or something like that, but I can legally conduct an investigation, discuss my results, do whatever I need to do. So I used open source intelligence combined with my private investigator spill stuff, Freedom of Information Act, platform requests, open records requests, 911 calls for service to a particular area or a particular address. I'll combine this all into a file, creating what I consider to be the most appropriate narrative. Now, I don't always share that just because I'm very protective of my company and my license, and I don't like being involved in lawsuits. I don't think anybody does. So I'm very careful. And then I go out into the community and I just talk in general about what I know about these events. Now, let's go ahead and break this down, okay? A false flag event to me is a FEMA drill taken live. How much money does our government spend on these events? This is the question that I've spent the last few weeks trying to get to the bottom of. But before you even get there, I want to talk to you about what our government spends to quote unquote protect us. That means to protect our minds from alternative narratives that might destroy faith in the government, protect us from terrorists who might come across the border, protect us from global thermonuclear war or biological events, protect us. They have to have money to run this protection machine. They have to have a budget to run this protection machine. And guys, let me tell you something. 9/11. Prior to 9/11, what we considered homeland security spending can be traced in my, the way I did my research, can be traced back to 1995. Okay. Homeland security wasn't established officially in 2003, but the spending in these different areas was still collected. Okay. In 1995, our budget for Homeland Security spending was $9 billion among a United States population of 265 million people, with an average of 2.6 people per household. There's 102 million households in the United States, which means that in 1995, the average quote unquote Homeland Security type spending per household was $88 per household, or $33.88 per person. Okay, so here's your baseline. I want you to think of it. $33 per person is what they spent to protect us for the things that are now called Homeland Security. Flash forward 2001. We have the Twin Towers. The budget still the same. It's had larger than cost of a living adjustment increases. So in other words, it's grown faster than inflation. It's grown faster than the economy, but the spending now in 2001 is $56 per person. It went from 1995, 3388, 6 years later, 2001, we're at $56 per person or $145 per household. Now, 2003, we have the Patriot Act had been passed as a result of 9/11. And the Patriot Act was the largest spending machine for a homeland security apparatus to protect us from outside actors. And that took that budget. Remember, in 95, it was $9 billion. In 2001, it had grown to $16 billion. In 2003, it had 192% increase up to $37,700. So that 1 year, it experienced 192% increase up to $37 billion. Folks, that budget, which is Homeland Security, includes FEMA, includes Customs and Border, Coast Guard, TSA, Immigration, Citizenship, Management or Secret Service, and Cyber Protection. 2001, the first round of Homeland Security spending nearly doubled our entire budget from $19 billion to pretty close to $40 billion. And jumped our spending from $67 up to $129 per person. Today, it has grown exponentially. In 2003, it was $37,700,000. Today, going into 2024, the budget next year is $103 billion. And the population has increased. In 2001, it was 285 million. Today, it's 341 million people. Folks, when Homeland Security first passed through, the budget was basically $336 per household. 2024, the budget will be $786.10 and 10 cents per household, of which FEMA, which is the portion of this budget that I considered to be running these fake shooting drills, FEMA represents approximately 23% consistently, not between 19 and 23% consistently in terms of the spending, which means that FEMA has a budget to run these operations in 2024 of 20, just FEMA alone has a budget of $29,899,000. Folks, there is plenty of money to run these operations. And the deeper I dig, the more I find that all these different government agencies, as their budgets increase year after year after year after year, they have to justify this. They need the American people to be scared. They need the American people to think that they're constantly being threatened by some outside force, and we need our big, expensive government agency to protect us. And so they execute these events. I don't know who got the first idea to execute this type of event, but it was brilliant and they pulled it off. I suspect it was Mossad or the Israelis, but I have no way to go back. I mean, there's been false flag events, Gulf of Tonkin. I mean, you can go way back on what are different types of false flags events. But I can tell you that it's my opinion that they use these events to justify the continued spending increases. Now, how did I come to this conclusion? Okay. How did I come to this conclusion? After I analyzed the Nashville shooting hoax, remember now Nashville just happened, what, in 2022? After I analyzed the Nashville shooting event, and I did it using the same techniques I talked about with Orlando and others, which is search engines, alternative, downloading earliest, most reliable evidence, finding everything. I'd done it with Buffalo. I'd done it Uvalde. I'd done it back in time with Sandy Hook. But fundamentally, we get to these events. And as I began looking under the hood, I found something that was consistent among all these events. A bomb threat. A drill. A misled, young, maladjusted, lone wolf sort of person who is probably mentally ill and a patsy, or maybe somebody that's just being paid to play a particular role. I found military style weaponry, outfits that all looked incredibly similar in terms of they've got their bulletproof vest or they've got their military equipment. And this was sort of the method that they used to drive this fear into the people. Now, when I was doing Nashville, I had an epiphany because I was delivering my Nashville presentation with Jim, and I think it was Giuseppe, and I think maybe Scorpio, but I'm delivering my presentation where I had busted down frame by frame. Again, I only analyzed earliest and most reliable evidence. I had broken it down. I had gone through it. And at the very end of the presentation, I showed this little snippet. I said, did you know that a local media station reported that at this Nashville shooter's house, the bomb squad had shown up and set off a bunch of bombs? And Jim was like, why did they do this? This is supposedly a tranny lesbo that went and shot up this school. Why did they do this? And as I sat and thought about it, I think it was maybe 5 or 6 hours ago, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Boom. They have to have multiple threats to justify multiple expenditures within their agencies, multiple programs. We need bomb sniffing robots. We need bulletproof glass. We need specialized vehicles to go tear down houses. We need all this. Think about it from their perspective. Guys, how do we build these budgets and walk through the halls of Congress every year and get it justified that we're going to have a 5.7% or 2.4% increase in our budget? And it's actually growing much faster than the cost of living adjustments. But think about these guys that are trying to pull the government agencies, the private contractors that are pieces of the government agencies. They have to be able to walk through the halls of their state or the federal government, and they have to be able to convince them that the American people need them to increase the budget. And every year, year after year. So if you take that idea and you lay on top of it, what are the dates of all these suspected false flags? You see almost a straight correlation that grows over time. More false flags about the time they're getting ready to set up how much they're spending in their budgets. More and more money to get justified the bigger budget. More and more programs loaded in. More employees, more full-time employees, more equipment, more this, more that. It's a money machine. The fear machine and the security apparatus is a money machine that's giving FEMA enough resources today to be able to run right here in the United States of America. What I believe to be developing is a prison state. Yes, we are the prisoners, and they have $786 per household to spend on imprisoning us in our homes and in our minds. And that's just FEMA and Homeland Security. Think about all the other organizations that they use to try to imprison us in our minds, to convince us that these security budgets are justified, to convince us that all these government employees are justified, to convince us that we need to spend this tax money to support this. That's a lot of pressure. And they have to have an American populace that's scared as hell to justify that. That's my opinion on it. Years of study, years of research, multiple false flags, 137 different events scattered all the way through all of my experience with all of my research skills. My conclusion is they are building a prison for us. That's the end of my presentation, folks.
Well, Brian, that was simply sensational. And just for those who may be curious, I inadvertently left out a speaker that I definitely wanted to include. So while I had Brian, one today and one tomorrow, I put in Carl Herman, who certainly deserved in his spot tomorrow. So you got a condensation. I'm very impressed with Brian's work. I think he may be, when it comes to investigating false flags, in particular right here in the United States, he may be the best we have. I give him that strong an endorsement. And again, I reiterate, if you would like to download our law enforcement false flag and stage event checklist, and I highly recommend, because it has a lot of links to presentations of the past that are going to leave no doubt in your mind as to how these things are done again and again and again, just go to my blog, jameshfetzer.org, and scroll down to, like, it's on the homepage. It's like the fifth now, because of course I've been publishing others, and you'll find it and you'll be able to download it. Plus, for the presentations that Brian and I have done together about, for example, Buffalo, he has done the definitive work in exposing the sham of Buffalo, which was modeled after the Christchurch event, which was so amateurish that in New Zealand, you're fined $10,000 if you even have a copy of the video on your computer. And with regard to Nashville, where the shooter walks in wearing one kind of sneaker, they're black and white Vans, as I recall, and yet when the body is lying there dead, a close-up shows they're now colored Puma. I mean, they make these kinds of blunders. And where Brian did a slow-mo on the CAM shooting to show a bullet fired, the whole thing was fabricated in ways that are really astonishing. The school appears to be closed. That's typical. More to come about that, but I just tell you, go then to my BitChute channel, Jim Fetzer, and just do a search on Jim Fetzer, Brian Davidson. You'll have all this available to you. Absolutely outstanding stuff. Now, remember, we're going to have a question and answer session. We have two more speakers in this first initial grouping of four. Then, because Brian caught us up, we're actually back on schedule, even slightly ahead. I'll be introducing our next speaker here in a few minutes. For those who want to take a pit stop, this is a perfect time to do it. And then we'll have the speaker sessions. And you can raise any questions you like about any issues related to any of our speakers. Now, because this is internet, if there's any technical glitch, it'll take us a few minutes to repair, but just come back. You may have to regain access. I'm not assuming it'll happen, but since there's the chance, I just want to explain that we're going to deal with this and get us back on track at the earliest opportunity. Meanwhile, we got about 5 more minutes before I introduce our next speaker, Fred Luchter. There's so much to say about Fred. This is, again, another presentation you don't want to miss. Brian, thanks again for a sensational presentation. And we're now going to take a brief break. We'll resume in about 5. See you then.